Okay, welcome everyone. Why don't we get started? So welcome to the Lowy Institute. My name is Roland Raja. I'm the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Institute. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Mr. Pascal Lamy to deliver today's talk on the topic of globalization and the future of the Pacific. What role for the EU? The Pacific is, of course, Australia's region, so we take a very keen interest. It's also home to some of the smallest, most remote, and most vulnerable economies on the planet. So what happens in the international economy in the world, and in terms of international policy, obviously has a very big impact on these small and vulnerable economies. For that reason, the topic of Mr. Lamy's talk is, of course, of great interest. So Mr. Lamy, of course, needs no introduction, but I will provide one for him anyway. He is widely recognized as one of the world's most influential thinkers, and he is a committed European and member of the French Socialist Party. He was formerly, of course, the Director General of the World Trade Organization, serving two terms over 2005 to 2013, and before that was the European Trade Commissioner over 1999 to 2004. Currently, he is doing a variety of things, including most recently as the high-level facilitator for the successor to the EU partnership with the ACP countries, Africa, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. He's also serving in a number of other roles, including as the interministerial delegate for the preparation of the French candidature for the Universal Exhibition 2025. He is serving as president of the French Committee of the Pacific Economic Cooperation Council and serving as chair of the European Group of Experts in charge of evaluating the impact of EU research funding. He also sits on a number of boards for various non-profit, academic and international bodies. So with that, I'd like to welcome Mr. Lamy to the lectern to deliver his talk.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. As Roland Raja just said, the purpose of my spending 2 weeks in this region has to do with the future of the EU-Pacific relationship. As you may know, the European Union relationship with a number of developing countries is taking place within what we call the EU-ACP, African Caribbean Pacific Agreement, and this agreement, which was negotiated 20 years ago, which was signed in an African country, which is the capital of which is Cotonou, is ending in 2020, and we have to replace it by a new framework, more adjusted to the realities of today on the European side, on the Pacific side, and of course on the rest of the world side. So the European Commission, where I still have a few friends, has asked me, together by the way with Louis Michel, who's a Belgian, also former European Commissioner, to advise them on how to build this new partnership. Louis Michel had been attributed the Caribbean region and Western Africa, and I have been attributed Eastern Africa, Southern Africa, and the Pacific region, which I happen to know not that well, but a little more than European average. So that's my starting point, which is looking at the background, the big picture of this potential new arrangement, which of course will have to differ from the previous one, because in the meantime, 20 years have passed and things are quite different. The European Union is a different one from it was 20 years ago. It's larger because of successive enlargements. It is soon to be smaller because of Brexit, if and when it happens. It's an animal which is much more integrated than 20 years ago, notably following the 08 crisis and the way it revealed a number of weaknesses in the economic and monetary union, which then had to be fixed through a more integrated system. It's a continent whose neighborhood has become unstable as compared to 20 years ago. We have serious problems on the eastern borders of the European Union. We have serious problems with Turkey. We have serious problems with what's happened in the Middle East, including Syria and the refugee flows it triggered. So, in a way, we are a continent which is less safe than it was 20 years ago. And we are a continent where the debate about whether to further integrate the European Union is more vivid, sometimes more acid, than it was 20 years ago. Not that the anti-European forces are winning, at least on the continent. We've had experiences for the last year and a half or so in Austria with the presidential elections, in the Netherlands with the parliamentary elections, in France with the presidential elections, where the debate about Europe was won by those who were in favor of further European integration. And notably in France, this, as you know, was a main feature of the campaign and of the second round in the presidential elections. But still, the debate about whether and how we should go further is more important than it was. And of course, it led to this Brexit vote in June last year. So it's a different animal. The world is also, I think, quite different from what it was. Asia has a much bigger role in this world, and China within Asia has a much bigger role than it had 20 years ago, with a sort of more assertive position in many areas. The US, we usually look at this with a sequence of question marks, but for sure, at least in the region, the fact that Trump killed the TPP is something that has quite a lot of reverberation, even if many of my trade colleagues believe that TPP was already a zombie at the time, and that killing a zombie can make a lot of noise on Twitter, but probably not that much in reality. But the signal is there. For sure, a continent like Africa is much higher, at least on the EU agenda, than it was 20 years ago. The demographics of Africa are the ones you know, and this question of between this race, between demographic developments and economic developments, whether this will succeed in limiting migration from Africa to the European continent or the other way around, are, of course, a big issue. And understandably, most European public opinions will have an eye more focused on Africa than on the Pacific, with the sort of, you know, sort of difference of proportion between 1.2 billion people next door and 12 million people somewhere down under. We also have a world that is very different in that we now have a sort of grid International Corporation, which is the second generation of development goals, which we this time have called Sustainable Development Goals. And these Sustainable Development Goals are a clear common toolbox for engaging in an international cooperation. And of course, the S of SDGs has inevitably a big bearing on the relationship with this region, given the vulnerability of the Pacific region to climate change. In this way, the Pacific region has also changed. Most of the Pacific countries, the leaders of which I met with bilaterally in Nouméa last week at the occasion of the Pacific Community Forum, most of these countries are a bit less poor, but are more vulnerable than they were 20 years ago to climate developments. The state of the oceans, and I know that I was a member of the Global Ocean Commission, has not improved. The ocean cycle is still, unfortunately, in a course of degradation, hence a threat on marine resources, which might not have been there 20 years ago. Overall, the region is, let's say, regionally a bit more structured than it was 20 years ago, including with French overseas territories in New Caledonia, in French Polynesia, and to a lesser extent in Wallis and Futuna, more integrated into a regional Pacific game. Australia and New Zealand remain, as they were 20 years ago, a major player in relationship with the Pacific countries. Both countries have, during these 10 years, developed a more sophisticated, a more consistent approach with these regions, which, of course, we Europeans have to factor into our reflections. So that's the few bits of the big picture I wanted to share with you. It's very sketchy, as usual, extremely incomplete, but those are the main features which I believe the EU should be considering while reflecting on what next about the EU-Pacific relationship. And this takes us to a sort of agenda, which, of course, and that's, as I already said, one of the reasons of my being here, either in New Zealand this week or in Australia, last week or in Australia this week, that's, of course, entails a dialogue between the European Union and both New Zealand and Australia, which is happening, and by the way, which has been happening. There is much more interaction, discussion, trust, convergence in many ways today than was the case in the past, which I think is a good thing to do. And this also has to do with the fact that the EU-New Zealand-Australia relationship is also about other than just the Pacific, and I'm notably thinking in trade terms, at this next negotiation, which should start, I expect, and I'm not speaking for the European Commission or for the European Union, I'm only speaking for myself, which in my view should start sometime around the end of this year, and which should not be that a difficult one. Although, as usual, a few details which look like devils here and there on agriculture or GIs or whatever. But I think this is a development that is taking place and that will shape partly the EU relationship with the region, including with the Pacific. And I think it's also one of the consequences or possible consequences of a, let's say, US stance, which is much more uncertain, volatile, and unpredictable than in the past in this area. So, a higher interaction with Europe. Brexit will probably create a situation where the view here in Australia or in New Zealand that the road to Brussels used to be through London, which has been the case for a long time, needs to be changed. There has to be a direct connection between the countries and the region and Brussels or Strasbourg once, again, if and when Brexit happens. And this will entail a series of developments which are not predictable at this time, but for sure, my view is that this will lead to a more consistent, more constant, in a way, more a nearer approach between EU, Australia, and New Zealand. We have, as I said, many reasons to do that with the Pacific countries. We have development reasons, we have the geopolitical reasons, we have the cultural reasons to do that. When you look at our EU trade arrangements with the Pacific countries and at Australia and New Zealand's PESA Plus systems, in many ways they are very similar. I mean, they're not identical, but the software, which is that opening trade, still makes sense in terms of economic integration, although we know that given the specificities of what size is in the Pacific, the benefits of regional integration will never accrue the way they do on a continent where the cost of distance is quasi-zero nowadays. But we have many reasons to do that together. What I got from my discussions, both with the Kiwis and here, is that our view of what the priorities of a Pacific policy engagement interaction are fairly similar. Environmental resilience, regional security, oceans, renewable energy, health, education. I think these are no-brainers, and that's probably going to be the headlines of what the EU will want to do and will propose to this region. Then there is, of course, the major question which has to do with how do we do that? What to do, I think, is a relative no-brainer. How to do it is a bit more complex. We have to take into account sensitivities in the Pacific areas. The Pacific Island Forum is probably the right approach for political dialogue. At first sight, will this be accepted as such by Pacific countries remains to be seen. We know there are different sensitivities here and there, and this is perfectly understandable. What about the implementation machinery? Should we interact with what exists? This CROPS, which are under Pacific Forum overview, although quite a number of them are run by specific systems. These are issues on which we have to consult very closely, again, with Australia and New Zealand. That's the sort of connection which we need to improve. I mean, should we if and when we get to agreement on the terms of this partnership, should we cooperate more, less, differently with Australia and New Zealand? My own sense, for what it's worth, is that there is a scope for more in a relationship which is a relationship of trust. I mean, there are circumstances where talking about whether China has good or less good intentions in the region can be done with a friend you trust and which might not be done otherwise. And these are questions on which we need to have a view. Will the US remain as engaged as they've been so far for geopolitical reasons? Or will they retreat to a sort of military strategy approach where development issues, i.e. the infrastructures of security, economic, social developments matter less, is the sort of issue which we Europeans need to discuss with Australia and New Zealand, who have a better, nearer, more sophisticated approach than we sometimes Europeans have. So there's ample scope for more to do together. This will be my concluding point. And I'm now, of course, available for questions and answers, as is the tradition in a think tank like the Lowy Institute. I'm independent. I don't report to anybody apart from my French government position for this Universal Expo 2025. But Australia is not a member of the International Bureau of Exhibitions, so I don't have a conflict in interest in soliciting a favor from Australia, as I will have in the years to come with other countries. Thanks for your attention.
Yep. So, thank you, Pascal. So we now have some time for some questions and answers. So there are some roaming microphones around. So if you could just state your name and your affiliation, if you'd like to ask a question, please.
I'm Philippa Barr, Macquarie University. Will French interests in the Pacific be consolidated with the approach of the EU? And in particular, is there any prospect of further, military testing or any of those sorts of activities?
As you know, the military component of the EU is at a very baby stage. For a long time, there's been a debate about that. Most of the EU military stance so far has gone through NATO. And the question of whether it should be 100% NATO and 0% EU or 50% EU and 50% NATO has been going on for some time. No doubt that the prospect of Brexit is changing this equation. No later than a month ago, the European Commission tabled a proposal to the Council and to the Parliament that €500 million from the EU budget should go to defence research, which is a big step forward. I mean, had I thought when I joined Brussels with Delors 30 years ago that one day the European Commission would propose to have a European Defence Research Fund, I would never have thought that would be possible. So things are slowly moving in this direction. But so far, most of the operations that have engaged troops, people with risks, have been done on a national basis, except for some exceptions in Australia, or in extremely close cooperation, like fighting marine piracy along the East African coast. So far, this remains mostly a national competence. My view is that it will change with time, although it would be, in my view, totally utopian to believe that the tail of defense can drive the dog of security policy.
Hi, my name is William from Xinhua. I was just wondering, do you think that China's Belt and Road Initiative can play a role in facilitating the ease of connectivity between the EU and the Pacific, considering the amount of investment that they're planning on doing within that region?
Yeah, overall, yes. I mean, the One Belt, One Road is one signal which China is sending that cooperation is the right way to go, although we know that China is not always sending this signal in every direction, and notably in the China Sea issues. So it's, I interpret it as, yes, China intends to engage for its own benefits. And I think I interpret the One Belt, One Road initiative as a sort of a second wave of China hedging its position in making sure that its respiration with the rest of the world, economy-wise, will work. The first step in the direction was China joining WTO in 2001, and I have some reason to remember that. So that's, in my view, sort of long-term strategy. And I would not be surprised if the Asian Investment Bank was to develop a relationship in this region. And if my information is correct, the president of the Asian Investment Bank is going to start a Pacific tour quite soon. So no surprise.
Thank you. Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute. The EU is the second largest donor to the Pacific Islands region. What do you think the priorities should be for that development assistance in a region that has such, in many ways, intractable development challenges?
Yeah, we are the second donor in this region. We are the first donor worldwide, the second donor in this region after Australia. And in my view, the sort of thematic headlines, reasons for engagement, are roughly the same as the one Australia has. There is obviously a proximity issue, and, you know, PNG may be more important in the bilateral relationship of Australia with the region, and we may have a bit of a different Polynesian focus or Melanesian focus or Micronesian focus, but overall, I think our software is the same. It has to do with, let's say, security in the wider sense. Security, stability, sustainability. And I think we now live in a world where these issues are extremely connected to one another. I think if this region has to endure climate migrations, this is a security problem. If the capacity of these countries to patrol their waters is quasi zero, this will have security consequences in the future. So I see this as a whole. We have to have a holistic approach to security, and a holistic approach to security in the Pacific is not exactly what a holistic approach in security is in Africa or the Caribbean or other continents. So, and again, what the reasons Australia and New Zealand have to engage in this region and our reasons, although we are not the same, in my view, are extremely similar. And there's behind this something that has to do with values. Twitter-like, we have a problem. Now, whether Twitter governs reality is an issue we all have to think very deeply about, because it's important for the future of this planet. I can see signs of geopolitical frictions with North Korea or with the China Sea. I can see signs of U.S. excitement about how to trade with China. That's a big question. Published a book in France this year, which is being translated in English. I'll have to review that by the end of August, about whether geoeconomics are trumping geopolitics, or whether we are back to to see this as a trap, where geopolitics would trump geoeconomics. At the end of the day, my own view, long term, is that geoeconomics will trump geopolitics. So the factors that are connecting U.S. and China will be stronger than the factor, the shaping factors that would lead to a deep divide and even worse, to a conflict. I'm not 100% sure I'm right. I simply believe that we've reached a stage of globalization in economic and technological terms. We now live in a planet which is so interwoven, interconnected, interdependent, that the cost of deglobalization and a big fight between US and China would be a deglobalization. The costs of deglobalization are now so high that we should be protected from deglobalization. I'm not 100% right. Again, I'm right. I can see why others can think differently, but that's my experience. I may be influenced by my trade background. If I look at Trump and trade, so far, more bark than bite. So far.
Thank you. I'm Greg Colton from the Lowy Institute. There are two referendums coming up in the region shortly. One involves the European Union in New Caledonia. The other one, which is probably far more likely to be destabilizing in the region, is Bougainville. The EU has traditionally been very quick to recognize countries which declare independence. What would your advice to the European Union be on independence being declared by one or both of those through popular vote, bearing in mind that if it is granted, it will very likely be quite destabilizing for the region?
I mean, I always hesitate to answer questions starting with the big if. So it's exactly the sort of question which is difficult to answer, and especially when you don't know which side it will go. And I think this really is this is a matter for Federica Mogherini and the European Council of Ministers and the European Parliament. I think the big question is the one you raised. Which of these results would be the most destabilizing? And I'm sure the EU will not look for something that destabilizes the region. That's would be my sort of my expectation of what their approach will be.
Anton Drischke from the University of Sydney. I have a question regarding your evaluation of the comparative benefits between an Australian Free Trade Agreement with the European Union and the Australian Free Trade Agreement with Great Britain. How do you balance the two?
If and when Brexit happens, the UK will have the capacity to negotiate its own trade agreements with third countries. It will be EU-wise, a third country negotiating with third countries, like Japan negotiating with Korea, or Morocco negotiating with Turkey. Now, if we assume, for the simplicity of the answer, that UK exits the EU with a trade regime which is the EU one, which is the simplest way of doing WTO-wise, and which then will be adjusted, changed, upwards, downwards, here and there. How will this change happen depends entirely in answering one question, which I have no clue how the Brits want to answer it, which is, what is the proper trade policy for the United Kingdom? That's the big question. Any answer to what it would look like depends on answering this question. And so far, we haven't the faintest beginning of a first likely allusion of what this should look like. There's been no debate in the UK about that. And that's, you know, that's in a way puzzling. If I look at what's written by extremely expert people, academics, trade on what if WTO plus, minus, the only starting question, like for any country, is what do I believe is the right trade policy for my country? And then I'll have a negotiation, a discussion, arrangement with others who will believe they have their own interests, but that's the starting point. And until and unless we have a bit of clarity on that, it's all foggy.
Thanks. Wei from Sydney University. Given your trade background, I was wondering about your comments about global trade. Global trade volume has dropped, you know, in the last few years. Do you see this as a cyclical adjustment, or do you see this as a long-term trend where trade volume would continue to drop, or do you think it will pick up at some point? Thank you.
Well, if I may, global trade volumes have not dropped. They keep increasing. What is true is that the rate of increase of trade measured in volumes is not as high as it used to be. So what's happened is that the growth of trade measured in volume has slowed. It hasn't dropped. You have more trade measured in volume today than yesterday, and yesterday than the day before yesterday. What has changed, if you look at the numbers, is the ratio between trade measured in volumes and GNP. Measured, as we all know, a GNP is a sum of value addition. So what has changed is a relationship between pears and apples. For 20 or 30 years, pears have grown more rapidly than apples. But these are different things. And the reason why pears have grown more than apples is that as a result of the multi-localization of production systems with goods and services, for the same number of apples, you had more pears. If a car is built in one country and exported in another country, you have one pear for one apple. If a car is produced in five different countries and you measure trade volumes each time a bit of that car crosses a border, you have three pears for one apple, which is what happened during 30 years. Now, for a number of reasons, this ratio, which had increased roughly from 1 to 1 or 1 to 1.5 to 1 to 3, sometimes 1 to 4, is going down because the expansion of value chains for the moment is not retreating, but is slowing. So value chains, the multi-localization of production systems, they multi-localize less rapidly than they used for the last 20 or 30 years. As a result of that, this ratio between peers and apples is changing, and we are going back to a sort of 1 for 1, 1.5 for 1. So that's the explanation. That's what's happening. And nothing to be worried about, except that there are moments where investing in expanding your value chain has lower return than in the past, so you're not going to do that for the moment. But wait the next change in relative prices, and this will re-trigger a new set of multi-localization. And one can think, for instance, that if the price of carbon gets where it should be environment-wise, this will trigger a new form of multi-localization. The technical scientific conclusion of this long reasoning is that it's not really intelligent, clever to compare pears and apples. And what you should do is to have a trade measured in value addition compared to some of the GNPs which are value addition, which is, by the way, why I launched this crusade when I was EG of WTO in measuring trade in value addition, which, of course, is the right way to assess the economic impact of trade, and which, by the way, gives you a fairly different picture of what trade is than volumes. So the right lens are value addition. If you look at the US-China trade deficit in value addition, it's 40% smaller than what it is in volumes, not least because, you know, if an iPhone assembled in Chengdu has five times more US value added than Chinese value added, what the US import from China is US value addition. So measuring trade in volumes, let's say the Trump way, becomes more and more stupid. So I'm sorry to be a bit technical, but that's the way to go. If you want to understand what's happening in the international economy and the impact trade and trade opening or even trade restrictions have on economic growth, this is the way to do. So in a nutshell, I'm not crying wolf. I don't see this trade to GDP ratio changing as a result of whatever protectionist surge. We have had very little protectionism for the last 10 or 15 years as compared to the shock of the 08 crisis and what happened in the past. And, you know, what happened is a bit what happened in the 90s, at the end of the 90s with the Asian crisis. We now are, and this is back to the point I was making earlier, we now are at a stage of integration where the cost of this integration becomes prohibitive. I happen to believe that it's a good thing.
Thank you. That was very interesting. I'm Hervé Lemayeux at the Lowy Institute. Just veering back to foreign policy a little bit. We all know that attention spans in Brussels are very stretched at the moment. Is it wise to even be thinking as far afield as the Pacific? What are the immediate priorities, and can the EU afford to be thinking of the Pacific? That it's a bit of a devil's advocate question. And would you not be considering, or is this not a case where you should consider devolving Pacific policy to the individual member states that have the biggest stakes in the region? So in this case, France.
Now, as you know, I happen to be a big supporter of EU integration, and the reason for that is that I believe EU has a stake in this world. It's much more than an internal market or even a research common program or a common agricultural policy or a relatively sophisticated system of switching money from rich regions to poor regions. The EU, given its size, given its tradition, given its history, has a, in my view, legitimate ambition to influence the course of this planet. And the course of this planet is partly going to be happening in the 20 years to come in the Pacific. More certainly than we should have thought 20 years ago. For reasons, which I rapidly mentioned. And, you know, if you take the SDGs, what the SDGs tell you, and if we believe in SDGs, and I believe in SDGs as a proper frame, because it has quite a lot of legitimacy with public opinion. If you look at the grid of SDGs, the grid of SDGs tells you the Pacific will matter more. Now, is this a question of huge money? No. You know, the Pacific region gets roughly $2 billion a year, which is 2% of global ODA. Not, you know, not that a huge issue. And even with this, the ratio of dollar per head is probably 20 times higher in the Pacific than it is in Africa. So, all this to say that there is a case for the EU remaining engaged. By the way, this is what the Pacific countries wish. This is what New Zealand wishes. This is what Australia wishes. So, probably say something that it's not, you know, if that's good for them and people like me believe it's something we should do, there's a good case for moving forward. Now, can this be done by EU or by its member states? That's a question of A, efficiency, B, politics. I'm certain, although I'm French by origin, I'm certain that a Latvian or a Slovak will be more inclined to pay a bit for the Pacific if it's done by the EU and not by France. For reasons which, you know, have to do with human psychology. If the EU would say the EU money goes through France, a lot of diplomats in Brussels would say, ooh, I mean, France is going to pull the rag in the French direction. This is all going to be for New Caledonia and French Polynesia. And what about Tuvalu and a new way? And so it's human psychology. So for these two reasons, I think, A, there are serious economies of scale to be done in doing things at the proper level. It doesn't mean that GTZ is not working in the Pacific region. It's working in the Pacific region extremely well, by the way, and with quite a lot of EU money. And I haven't heard in Brussels that EU money through GTZ is bad money. So it works. I mean, we even run some EU programs with EU money with Australia. And by the way, Australia, we also run some African programs with Australian money. So that's the way to go because it's more efficient. Now, then whether the French will remain, I mean, committed to this region, I have no doubt about that. And we have a French president under the name of Emmanuel Macron who has, and I'm not playing domestic politics and say that, who has much more of a cockpit view of how this world should be run. And I'm convinced that the notion that oceans will matter more in the future than they do is something he has in mind.
Okay, thank you. So there are no more questions from the floor. I might take advantage to ask a final question, which is to put your old hat on and combine it with your new hat. The WTO is said to be facing a whole range of pressures and challenges in this new sort of world of increased protectionist tendencies and certainly at least rhetoric. What is your view about how this is going to play out? What's the future of the WTO and its role in promoting trade? And then coming across back to the Pacific, what's the Pacific's interests and how can the world trading system be made more favorable to the Pacific's development going forward?
No, I mean, I think in the future, I mean, trade will have to remain rules-based. So the name of the game, the rules according to which you trade, will remain extremely important because trade is a question of trust, and these rules play a big role in ensuring the sort of trustability of the system. Now, should these rules evolve? Of course. I mean, 30 years ago, the big thing was textile quotas and tariffs on socks and shirts. I mean, who cares today? I mean, the U.S., for whatever reason, which has to do with congressional politics, but the rest of the world, you know, believe that socks are commodities, which, by the way, is a view I share. I mean, my relationship with my socks, not such that there's a big emotional thing down there. So, but of course, how animals are slaughtered before they are traded becomes important. Nobody would have cared about that 50 years ago, but today we've got people on this planet, including here in Australia. When I was DG of WTO, we nearly had a WTO case at a time where animal activists here in Australia started saying that you should ban Australian export to live cattle, of live cattle to Indonesia, because they're slaughtered halal down there, and this is terrible for these poor animals. And this is the sort of thing which, you know, WTO now has to cope with, because meat is a big volume of trade. So things have to evolve. These issues are becoming more culturally connected. Deep integration inevitably leads to deeper ideological integration, and the WTO should do that. Although, whereas one can think that trade experts can negotiate tariffs, I'm not sure they are the ones who should negotiate animal welfare standards. This should be done by animal welfare specialists, like aflatoxin in nuts, or ractopamine in pork, or pesticide residues in flowers, or sanitary quality of fish and shrimp. So this is ahead. I don't think the WTO is in danger. There is one danger for the moment, which is that the jewel in the crown, as they say down there, which is the WTO dispute settlement, is damaged. And there's one country today which is trying to shake the dispute settlement, which is the United States of America. And by the way, this does not date from the Trump presidency. The Obama presidency already took a number of steps to question sometime the validity of trade, of the ways trade disputes are adjudicated in WTO. Like any country, the US, and it's the case for all the others, they like winning cases, they don't like losing cases. And there is a tendency to attribute the fact that you lose a case to whatever judicial activism, quote unquote. So that these judges are going farther than they should in interpreting the law. They are rewriting the law, and this is not acceptable. So that's where, for the moment, I see a risk. And it's a serious risk, because moving the rule book is difficult, complex, especially given that it takes place by consensus. And before the third millennial, I'm not sure there is any serious option other than consensus. I mean, even the EU, who's a spacecraft in supranationality, took 50 years to get to a double majority for voting decisions in the council. So don't expect that in the WTO. And I don't think if the US and China disagree in WTO, Brazil, South Africa, or even Europe are going to tell them, look, guys, you'd better agree, otherwise we'll create a big problem for you. So that's something which is inevitable. But the value of having a rule book, even if the rule book is a bit slow to adjust, and of having a supranational and diplomats will tell you that I misuse this word. I know. They hate this sort of adjective, which is what it is. The moment you lose a dispute and you have to abide to the result of that, you are in a supranational system. You remain in the Westphalian system as long as is the case with the Court of The Hague. You go to the court, they adjudicate, and then you say, I will or not implement the result of this, depending on my will. This is the normal international law system. Now, lawyers will tell you, and I've had lots of debates with them, and I respect them a lot, that the Court of The Hague decisions are compulsory, that they should be implemented. They are legally compulsory, except that you are sovereign, you decide whether or not to do it. In WTO, over. You have to, otherwise, there are what they call compensation measures, which in layman terms are sanctions. So this is an extremely important feature, which gives to the WTO a visibility and an efficiency in the system, which is much higher than other political organizations. And in my view, this should be preserved. I hope it will be the case, and I hope that those who have a big interest in keeping trade open, safe, predictable, which at the end of the day are not the states, but businesses, the ones who buy and sell, I hope that the value of that for them, which has allowed a huge expansion of international trade with enormous positive impacts, with serious negative impacts. And I've always said, even when I was a trade negotiator or a DG of the WTO, that we should not sell trade as a miracle solution. Trade works because it makes production systems more efficient because of competition. Trade works because Ricardo and Schumpeter have told us why it works, and we know it works because it's painful, and it's painful because it works. So I'm not saying trade is a miracle. What I'm saying is you are better with open trade than with closed trade. And that's what WTO is about, and this is why it should be preserved.
Thank you. So with that close, let me thank Pascal Lamy for a great talk. And a round of applause. And hopefully look forward to having you here again sometime. Thank you.